ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And in the second of our sweet Christmas treats for the month of December, I am joined by guest Lauren Humphreys-Brooks as we talk about the 1945 Barbara Stanwyck classic Christmas in Connecticut. And because it's the year's end, I wanted to honor a very special friend that we lost this year, if you're a TCM fan. So who best to introduce Christmas in Connecticut than our own Robert Osborne?
Hi, I'm Robert Osborne. It's Christmas in Connecticut from Warner Brothers in 1945. A really charming, lighthearted romp starring two people who had recently made indelible impressions in dramas. One is Barbara Stanwyck, who'd just been seen giving her great dramatic performance in Double Indemnity. And there's Sidney Greenstreet, the famous fat man of the Maltese Falcon and so many other sinister stories. Well, this time Barbara and Sidney lighten up considerably and are downright jolly, joined in this film by Warner Brothers' number one heartthrob of that time, Dennis Morgan. And you know, one of the great things about Barbara Stanwyck is you never knew how she'd show up in film. She might be playing a burlesque queen in a murder mystery, maybe a high society widow in a drama, or a cold-blooded rancher's wife in a western. And on rare occasions, as in our film, she tickles the funny bone and is an absolute delight doing it. From 1945, also with Reginald Gardner and S.Z. Cuddles the Call, we bring you Christmas in Connecticut.
Bob is definitely a tough act to follow, but let's include some trivia that he didn't mention in his introduction. Christmas in Connecticut was filmed in 1944, but it wasn't released until 1945. It was one of three movies that actress Barbara Stanwyck would make with director Peter Godfrey. The other two are very un-Christmassy, 1947's Cry Wolf and The Two Mrs. Carrolls. The story of a magazine columnist for Smart Housekeeping, who fakes a life of domesticity, was aimed at the countless working women struggling to balance home and hearth, with the need to put food on the table. During filming, Stanwyck was receiving notices for her work in the very un-Christmas film Double Indemnity. Though she'd worked in noir before and after, Stanwyck's Spider-Woman character Phyllis Dietrichson in Double Indemnity might have necessitated a need to show she could also be a happy woman seeking a husband and home.
Who said there isn't any Santa Claus? Look what I found in my stocking.
Heaven help a sailor on a Christmas like this.
This is the jolliest, merriest Christmas I ever spent.
Nah. It is so, so romantic. It gives me pimples all over the goose.
Like most movies of the era, Christmas in Connecticut was filled with several prominent Warner Brothers stars of the day, many of whom, like Stanwyck, fostered a fruitful relationship with director Peter Godfrey. Actor Sidney Greenstreet knew the director from their time together on the London stage. Unlike the wintry Miracle on 34th Street, Christmas in Connecticut was a happy production, with Greenstreet and Godfrey being known to bust up the cast and crew while filming with various imitations. The movie went on to receive rave reviews upon release in August of 1945, another summertime Christmas feature, and would become a holiday staple.
From director Arnold Schwarzenegger, here's America's happiest TV mom.
Look at my potatoes. Aren't they beautiful?
No wonder she's happy. She never has to cook.
Isn't that pretty?
Her husband is just made up. And the kids? Rented. Only one thing could mess up her perfect life.
Christmas in Connecticut!
Unlike other Christmas movies from the studio era, Christmas in Connecticut was not one to suffer from endless remakes. Though, if you listen to that trailer, that doesn't mean they didn't make the attempt. In 1992, a television remake of Christmas in Connecticut was produced by Turner Pictures, starring Diane Cannon as Elizabeth Blaine, a cooking show host forced to cook a Christmas meal on air for forest ranger Jefferson Jones, played by Kris Kristofferson. One really only has to take a look at the box cover for this movie, with Diane Cannon in a form-fitting dress and apron holding a pie aloft in heels, to know it's probably not going to please purists. And I cannot recommend enough watching the trailer for this movie, because it is the most bizarre concoction, with Tony Curtis trying to seduce Diane Cannon. And we're not talking Tony Curtis in the 50s, we're talking Tony Curtis in 92. Reviews for the TNT production were lackluster to be kind. One critic wrote, quote, "You'll be hungry for a better movie after suffering through this film." And just who was the director of this misfire? If you didn't hear it the first time, it was the Terminator himself, Arnold Schwarzenegger. After the break, Lauren Humphreys Brooks and I take a trip to visit Christmas in Connecticut.
I'm wishing that I may. I'm wishing that I might have the wish that I wish tonight. I've told my lucky star the wish that I made, and every time so far she's come to my aid. And maybe by tomorrow, if I wish with all my might, I might have the wish I wish tonight.
But another Christmas treat for you is looking at the 1945 film Christmas in Connecticut. This is probably one of my favorite Christmas movies. I know I said that about Miracle on 34th Street, but this ranks a bit higher for me. And of course, I am joined with my special guest for this week's, the fantabulous Lauren Humphreys Brooks. Lauren, how are you?
I am doing pretty well today. Thank you.
Thank you for jumping on to talk Barbara Stanwyck and feminism. For people who don't know who you are, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am on the podcast Citizen Dames with you. Former master's student at NYU. I have a degree in film studies and a degree in creative writing from the University of Edinburgh. So I've got all kinds of money is just rolling in for me. I run a blog at Suddenly a Shot Rang Out, which is just basically me talking about whatever I feel like. Right now it has been largely feminism, which is true for probably most of us right about now. And I am very loud and obnoxious on Twitter.
Christmas in Connecticut is probably one of the few feminist Christmas films that I could probably explain. And for some people, that might sound like a stretch. But we're going to discuss that. Plot in a very thin nutshell is you have Barbara Stanwyck plays Elizabeth Lane. She is a writer for, I know it's not Good Housekeeping, but I forget the name of the magazine that she writes for. It's owned by Sydney Greenstreet's Alexander Yardley. She has created this persona of being the all-American wife and mother with a house in Connecticut. She ends up getting a sailor soldier on leave who is saved from a raft, Jefferson Jones, played by Dennis Morgan, who comes to her house for Christmas, and she has to fake having all the stuff that she has touted that she has. It's such a complex, bizarre film. Like you could say about a lot of the Christmas movies that were made during World War II, post-World War II. It's actually the second post-World War II film that we've talked about during the Christmas season. This was actually a bit closer. World War II would actually end about 3 or 4 weeks after this movie came out. So this came out August 11th of 45. War ended September 2nd of 45. So a couple weeks would pass. So this is still technically in the midst of the war. I don't know if you noticed it, but watching it this time and knowing that context, it's for me, it was bizarre watching this so closely after watching Miracle on 34th Street, which if you listen to that episode, I said was 2 years after the war and you were still feeling the fallout. And I don't know, I'm not a big World War II buff, but I don't think it could have foreseen that the war was going to end so quickly after its release. But you can still see that it's a World War II film and the whole concept of wanting to bring our troops and honor our soldiers, but at the same time, reminding women of what they had lost in terms of domesticity. This is not nearly as terrifying and afraid of women as something like Leave Her to Heaven, which pretty much reminds you that while you've been gone, your women could have gone crazy. But this really does reiterate, on the one hand, and I'm going to make the argument that I think it's actually a bit more subversive than it is, but it does, I think the surface argument is reminding women, you should know these things about how to raise a baby, how to find a husband, how to flip a pancake, things like that. Lauren, we didn't really jump into overall thoughts, but how do you feel about this as a World War II film and your background watching this for this episode?
Well, it's interesting, actually, because I knew that it was somewhere around World War II, but I didn't know whether it was during the war or just post-war when I watched it. And then I looked it up. It came out, I think, in 1945. but it was made in 1944. So we're still in the middle of the war. It's, if I remember my history correctly, it's beginning to swing to the Allies, but it is by no means a done deal. But what actually struck me about watching this film is that it does feel almost post-war. I agree with what you're saying about the movement back towards domesticity. It's like these are all of the things that the men have been missing. On the one hand, like the whole plot with Dennis Morgan's character is that he misses home cooking. He wants this very romantic sort of ideal vision of a woman and a home and, you know, a farm in Connecticut during Christmas, all of that stuff. But there's a sense of optimism, I guess, in the film that you don't get in the same way, even in some of the propaganda films of World War II, that the boys are coming home. And they are going to come home to maybe not exactly what they expected, but definitely at least a somewhat idealized vision of this America that they have left behind and that they have been fighting for. The experience looking back on it, it felt more post-war than, like, well, I mean, Casablanca or anything like that, but any of those films that were made around about the same period, with before D-Day, before the war had actually ended in any sense.
Elizabeth Lane as a character, we wouldn't see Dear Abby founded until like 56, I think. She was actually based on a columnist named Gladys Tabor, who was popular with Family Circle and lived in a farm in Connecticut. There's so much bizarre back and forth with how this movie treats domesticity, which we'll get to in a second, but we didn't talk about our overall history with this movie, which I think is important for us as female writers. We talk about feminism a lot. I saw this for the first time, I think, back in 2013, and I cannot tell you why, what the impetus was for me to watch it, but I loved it so much. I think a lot of it has to do with how good Barbara Stanwyck is, and I think this is probably one of her best non-noir performances. I hate Dennis Morgan with a fiery passion. I think this is the reason why I hate. I know. We'll talk about Dennis Morgan in a second. Dennis Morgan is what I call the Army Hammer of 1945.
Whoa.
Not personally. In acting.
I was gonna say that's a weird reaction.
Acting wise, I really hate his character and I hate the way he acts in this movie, but I'm gonna irritate all the Dennis Morgan fans in a little bit. I love how creative this movie gets. You see a lot of these high concept movies where it's like high juggling, you know, a lot of balls in the air trying to figure out how you're gonna pull off this big ruse. The movie almost seems self-aware in certain instances, which I think is very fun with the multiple babies and things like that. I enjoy this movie a lot. Lauren, what's your background with this before we recorded?
I don't remember the first time I saw it. I know that I saw it on TCM, and it was probably during the Christmas period. It was just one of those movies that was on, and I, of course, began watching it because Barbara Stanwyck. I will say, I'm not a big Dennis Morgan fan or anything like that. I think he's cute in this film. I could probably name 10 actors that would be more interesting in the part. I really liked it, and the whole concept is very, this is a mid-40s film, but it's a very 1930s screwball comedy concept. It's just like, this woman who can't cook, can't housekeep, can't do anything, has to pretend for her boss and for this attractive young soldier boy to be this married housewife. And of course, she falls in love with the soldier. Of course that's going to happen. What else is going to happen in a screwball comedy? One of the things I do love about this film, the secondary cast. Just nothing but brilliant character actors. Everybody. I mean, Sydney Greenstreet. Right now I'm blanking on the name of the man who plays her friend who's the cook.
S.Z. Sakal.
Who's also in Casablanca. And I looked up the other day that he had actually escaped, I believe, from Hungary originally. And his sister had died in a concentration camp. So there's all sorts of interesting background with him.
Una O'Connor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, she's amazing. I love her.
Another actress that I've openly griped about on this podcast. If you listen to my Bride of Frankenstein review, it was just my utter annoyance at Una O'Connor.
And Reginald Gardner, who I know originally from The Man Who Came to Dinner, who is, again, hilarious. And he's not as brilliantly funny in this one as he is in that film, but he's still marvelous. So the secondary cast that is surrounding Stanwyck, who is already a very good comedian and a very good dramatic actress, obviously, is just so strong that even in the places where you're not sort of following her story, where you're just dealing with them and their reactions to everything that's going on, is just quintessential screwball comedy. So I do love the film for that.
I do appreciate the fact that the cabin that they're in, speaking of screwball comedies, is actually the same cabin from Bringing Up Baby.
I was wondering about that, actually, yeah. Watching it. I was I feel like I've seen this place before.
You're expecting Cary Grant to run out in a robe talking about how he went gay. I mean, it's just, it's amazing. You bring up a lot of things, and I'm not sure where we want to start. Let's talk about the film being kind of a feminist Christmas movie, at least. Mm-hmm. You're introduced to Jefferson Jones. He's on this raft with his buddy, Seaman Sinkowitz. They end up going to this army hospital. He's not allowed to eat real food because he starved for too long. Mm-hmm. The entire crux of this movie hinges on the fact that he is hungry. And I could say that a lot of their relationship between Barbara Stanwyck and him is the fact that she is thirsty.
Yes.
You have that. His whole intention is he's gonna get his nurse to marry him so that he can get real food. You're thinking, okay, that's weird, but sure. Said nurse decides to get in touch with Sydney Greenstreet's character because she nursed his granddaughter back to health after some unknown illness, which leads to, I mean, it's a very thin sequence of events that gets us from A to B. Once we finally meet Barbara Stanwyck, I don't know about you, but I love her introduction in this film because she's writing this article about the view outside her window and how fire's crackling in the fireplace, and you're seeing actually that it's like the radiator of her little crappy apartment, and she doesn't have any of those things. She's cultivated this cachet as having being upwardly white female 1940s woman. And all of the men in this film are pretty much reiterating to her that she needs to listen to them. Like, her agent, he has a family to support. Yeah. And his wife is not gonna be understanding if he doesn't lose his job. So Elizabeth has to convince Sydney Greenstreet to cancel this whole trip. Whereas Sydney Greenstreet says, you know, you don't want to disappoint the American public. So she decides to go along with it. There's even a moment where Jefferson Jones wants to watch her bathe the baby, and he says, well, you're not going to disappoint me, are you? I mean, it's just watching this poor woman be at the mercy of male disappointment and persevering, but you still are just shaking your head.
I have mixed feelings about it. First time I saw it, I was, oh, this is a cute 40s Christmas movie, isn't it sweet? And then the second time, yeah, I was just like, ooh, there are some things in here I'm not certain about. I mean, I agree with you. All of the men are sort of pushing their individual expectations off on her. And they're different expectations also. You've got her agent who's just like, I can't lose my job, I have a family. It's a legitimate concern of his. He's also been sort of selling this lie the entire time. You've got Yardley who demands a similar thing to what the Dennis Morgan character demands, Jones, which is that I want this pristine all-American Christmas, which is, again, the nostalgia and the view of American life that she has been selling all of this time. You have her boyfriend, or not half-boyfriend guy that she that wants desperately to marry her, who, again, is just basically looking for... I can never tell if he loves her or if this is actually... He's just basically looking for that very precise, I'm a single man with this farm in Connecticut, and now I'm going to get married, and it's going to be someone that's going to be a good companion and further my career. And that's kind of the attitude.
He keeps emphasizing throughout the movie tradition. It's traditional. And I think that that's what he's looking for. It's tradition to be married, and that's what he needs. And I think that that's really interesting to look at. Both him and Elizabeth are kind of self-made people. Elizabeth has cultivated this image as a wife and mother, but she's done it as a single woman who lives alone. And John is this successful architect who has created, the belief is that he's created his own business. He's literally like built this house. They're both self-made people that up until this whole plot falls into place have been very content with not being married to each other.
I mean, it's implied a couple of times that he's asked her to marry him numerous times, and she has kept on saying no. And her excuse is totally legitimate. She doesn't love him. And she's told him that several times. And he's like, well, but you could love me later, maybe. It's interesting that they are all demanding different kinds of things from her. They're all subordinated things. but she's got to fulfill some kind of image that they have of what women are supposed to be, of what she is supposed to be, and of how women are supposed to work for men. That being said, she kind of rebels against it at each turn. And she isn't those things. She isn't the good American housewife. She isn't the helpmeet that is going to advance her husband's career. She isn't even really beholden to her agent who's trying to get her to basically pretend to be all of these things in order to protect his career. And she finally does sort of enforce what her desires are. And her desires are for Jones.
I love is that the men are the ones who are obsessing over this need for marriage and children. Instead of her, she shows up and they believe the baby gets kidnapped at a certain point. They are all upset, all the men are freaking out, and she just shows up and she's like, it's not my baby, I don't really care. It all comes to a point when Yardley is actually telling Sloane that the competitor, there's an Elizabeth Lane equivalent at another magazine, and she's having a baby. And so he's pretty much telling John, you guys need to have another baby right now, as soon as possible. It's subversive because they're not married. And so Yardley unwittingly is telling them to, like, engage in this illegitimate child rearing. But at the same time, it's also telling you, I mean, and you could say, and depending on whether we've gotten better or worse since 1945, you have two men arguing woman's ability to get pregnant and have a baby. They're not even consulting her about whether she wants to have another child, even though that no child exists. They're making these decisions about her future without consulting her, which I think is sad, yet it shows them to be completely ridiculous.
It establishes that they're constantly imposing their image of womanhood on her. And the thing is, they don't even have a legal right to do it. He's not married to her. She can quit her job. She does not have to be beholden to any of these men, yet they're still, okay, you have to fulfill this image that I have of what you are. And eventually she's just like, actually, I kind of don't.
I think that that's a testament to Barbara Stanwyck as a performer, because originally Betty Davis was cast, and then she ended up doing The Man Who Came to Dinner. I don't think this would have worked as well with Betty Davis, because Betty Davis was always a tough broad. She was definitely sharp and could be murderous if put in the right performance. I just don't believe that she would have let these guys bully her for an instant. Barbara Stanwyck, I think, is the perfect bridge, because she's feminine and soft enough to go along with it, but she's also dominant enough without being threatening.
At the same time, though, this film comes out, what, like a year after Double Indemnity?
Which you could argue was the studio's attempt to make you think, hey, she's not this Black Widow figure. I think that this might be a response to that film.
It's interesting because obviously in that film, again, she is a character who is eventually punished for it, but she is rebelling within the structure. She is rebelling against all of the things that the structure tells her she has to be. And she uses all of the men around her to that end. I'm not saying that Christmas in Connecticut is a screwball version of Double Indemnity, but
give it time.
I could probably write an essay that would convince you of it. But it does sort of use that view of women in a particular role and defining themselves based upon what all of the men around them want them to be. And basically using that and finally going after the thing that they actually want in the end.
I see this as a trilogy of Barbara Stanwyck rebels against. Because if you look at it, you have Double Indemnity in 44, you have this in 45, and then you have My Reputation in 46. Which, if anybody has seen that movie, if you haven't, you should, because it's probably my second favorite Barbara Stanwyck movie. It's a story about her playing a widow with two small children who takes up with this, again, an army officer played by George Brent, who was Betty Davis's boyfriend. So again, it goes back to that Betty Davis connection. These two start dating, and everybody, including her children, are trying to tell her, father's only been dead 5 years, or I forget how long the guy's been dead. How dare you move on? And she plays a similar character who's like, look, I understand the need for decorum, and I understand my past life is like a wife and a mother, but I also am a person. It's a very interesting trio of films that she did at this point. because they're all really just emphasizing how much of an individual a woman should be allowed to be, as well as being wife and a mother, that you can have it all in a way and not really lose yourself. I don't know if you've seen the other Christmas movie that Barbara Stanwyck has done, which is Remember the Night. Remember the Night came out in 1940. It's actually an earlier film she did with Fred McMurray before they did Double Indemnity together. I know a lot of people who love Remember the Night. I've watched it several times. It's not my favorite, but she plays a shoplifter who ends up going to spend Christmas on a farm with Fred McMurray's character, who is the prosecutor of her case. Legalities are a little wonky in this movie. I think this one works a bit better because it is Stanwyck dominating the frame. Remember the Night, it's Fred McMurray. He's the prosecutor, so really you're questioning how their relationship can work with the power dynamic that they have. Whereas here, it's the fact that Jefferson Jones is making moves on her, knowing that she's married, in theory, quote-unquote. She's the one controlling all these events, even though events are controlling. It's a really weird dance that happens in this film. You brought up the men. So we have Jefferson Jones, played by Dennis Morgan, and you have John Sloan, played by Reginald Gardner. What do we think about both of these guys? That's why I think there's a little bit of feminism in this movie. Her options are tradition. John wants to play the wedding march because it's traditional. He plays into this whole concept of domesticity versus Jefferson Jones, who really, you can only say her attraction to him is blatantly sexual.
Yeah, you were talking about like the way that Stanwyck deals with the male characters. The way that she looks at Dennis Morgan, just the sheer number of shots, and even rewatching it again, I was just like, damn, there's so much female gaze going on here. You said earlier, she's thirsty. She's just like, this guy walks in and she's just like, yes, yes, whatever this is, I am gonna go for it. This is great. Oh my God. She's just completely, incredibly sexually attracted to him from the word go. There are not a lot of films from this period that really represent that, that show like this woman just being, regardless of whether or not the audience feels it, she's just like, yeah, this is the guy. This is the I. Something's gonna happen.
There's really no sugarcoating it. And when we say it's blatant, it is blatant in this movie. And it's not in like a drunken, boozy way, like they set up the Philadelphia Story, which I love the Philadelphia Story, but a lot of the interaction that people remember between Katharine Hepburn and Jimmy Stewart is when they're drunk.
Yeah.
Whereas this, it's just she opens the door and that Barbara Stanwyck face just totally changes.
Yeah.
A lot of the lines, and I could just be because my mind is in the gutter, but a lot of the lines between the two of them play as very double entendre.
Yeah.
He's talking about the rocking chair or the cow. There's a cow that shows up at a certain point. They have to put the cow out in the barn and he says something, nice firm rump, and she stands up and is talking about, she thinks he's talking about her. And then there's a scene where they're like lying in the snow and Sloane shows up and she's just like, I don't even care, man. Go away. I don't think there's a deeper relationship there between the two of them. Do you buy at the end that this is a relationship that's gonna last forever? Or is that the point that the movie's trying to make? I think you can argue that the relationship works because they both know what they want out of the other person and they're accepting of that. But then I could also make the argument that these two are just gonna have some sort of fling and she's just gonna go back to being single, which is totally fine. Do you think that this is the love that lasts forever?
I mean, I don't know. First of all, it's played as a very light film. So we don't have this sense of depth. You mentioned the Philadelphia Story, but by the time that Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant get together at the end of the Philadelphia Story, you're like, yeah, these two are in love with each other. They've been in love with each other for a very long time. You even get that in bringing up Baby. In this, maybe not so much, but I think that's also part of the quality of the film. None of this is deep. I buy that they get together at the end of the film. I buy that they will have a relationship, whether or not that relationship is going to end in like marriage and kids and a house in Connecticut, I do not know. But it's definitely a much more suitable relationship for her than Sloane. Basically, it seems like either Dennis Morgan or she's going to continue to be single because her going off with Sloane just doesn't make sense. It is that totally traditional and totally cold. And she obviously wants and needs someone who's going to be hot. And she is hot for Jefferson Jones.
I think that that works to the movie's advantage, because it's also important to remember that Jefferson Jones was going to marry a woman for food. I don't think we can ignore that. Marriage vows are already questionable to this character. I've come to appreciate the ending a bit more, because it ends with this weird double entendre where they're locked in a room together and everybody's waiting outside for what's going to happen. Yeah. And the fact that this God's machine of the nurse decides that she's going to marry someone else, so Jones is free to do what he wants, and then he realizes that Barbara Stanwyck is not married. Mind you, he's been knowingly flirting with her this entire movie with the tacit knowledge, as far as he knows, that she is married with a child. I think it's totally okay. At the end of this movie, I don't feel like if these characters just wind up in bed together, that's fine. That's cool. Everybody's happy by the end. That's all that matters.
I do think that the fact of her marriage is actually one of the things that permits them to be as familiar with each other as they are. So you have the scene in the barn. You have the scene where they're going riding together in the sleigh nearing the end of the film. You have the scene where they're bathing the baby, which is one of the moments where she just looks at him like,
he is the last cupcake on the tray.
Absolutely. And it's because he's this man who's engaging in this very domestic act and talking about how his sister's kids always love him and he had to be the one to give them baths because he was so good at it. But because she's married, there's a degree of familiarity that they can have that maybe wouldn't be acceptable if they had met where she's just this single woman and he is this single man. They can sleep under the same roof together. They can go walking together. They can have these very intense exchanges that gradually become sexual, but they're also not sexual because she's married. And then on the other side of it, you have someone like Sloane, who is treated as largely asexual. You don't really feel like there's any, not really any attraction on his part for her. She is something that he needs to acquire.
And it's important to note that Nora is the one who believes that they are sleeping together without being married.
Yeah.
No one else believes that, but she is the one, and I think it's important to point out that there is a lot of bizarre attraction for Una O'Connor in this movie, because not only does she believe that they're definitely having sex and that she cannot abide under their roof with that, she's also mistaken as Elizabeth Lane when the judge shows up to marry Elizabeth and John for the first time. He thinks that Nora is Elizabeth. No disrespect to Una O'Connor, but the humor is that she's like significantly older. You're already seeing what people expect John to be with, and it's not Barbara Stanwyck.
He is continuously desexualized throughout the film, even in his manner and the way that he talks and the way that he relates. There's no impression that he is even really attracted to Elizabeth. And then you contrast that with Jones, who is quite obviously attracted to Elizabeth, who, you know, sits down at the piano and sings and bathes the baby and has this wonderful dream about Christmas being in Connecticut and eating all of this wonderful food and having all of this done for him. You know, there's this combination of sexuality and domesticity in his character that, in contrast with someone like Sloane, who's the other suitor, as it were, it's just like, hands down, come on, no one is going to choose Sloane over this, and the movie doesn't expect you to believe that she would.
That leads us to talking about Dennis Morgan in this film. So I've already mentioned a couple of my issues with him. If we're looking at how Elizabeth and John are self-made characters in this movie, Jefferson Jones is the one who is just really hoping to glom on to somebody who's already got stuff already set up. He doesn't want to have to work that hard. He's literally fed in one scene. I'm just like, come on, man. I've seen Dennis Morgan in a couple things. It's why I call him, actor-wise, not personally, the Armie Hammer of the 1940s, because he always plays the same character, which is the good-looking, nice guy that you could see as playing a Disney prince. In the 40s, because of the studio era, there's not a whole lot of ways to deviate from that. I think of this in like Kitty Foyle, if anybody's seen Kitty Foyle with Ginger Rogers, where his character is making poor Ginger jump through hoops for him. It's like, dude, you're cute, but I don't know how I feel about you. And in this movie, they definitely play up the female gaze, and he's definitely cute with the kids, but if I'm looking at the great legacy of Barbara Stanwyck leading men, he does nothing for me, and he annoys the crap out of me in this movie.
He doesn't annoy me. I actually had to look him up because he was one of those actors that I was like, I've seen him in stuff, but I don't know.
A lot of musicals.
I was like, I don't know what, and he's definitely not memorable, so I don't find him annoying in this. He is bland. He's not Fred McMurray or Gary Cooper or pretty much anyone else that Barbara Stanwyck worked with. Some of the backstory of his character is interesting because if I remember correctly, he talks about never really having had a home, never particularly getting to have that opportunity to be in like this very domestic sphere. He's coming from starving on a raft after being blown up. So you kind of understand that maybe he might be longing for this nostalgic vision of American life and American womanhood that he's never really experienced. I have some sympathy for his character and the deus ex machina at the end where the nurse comes back and is just like, oh, by the way, we can't actually get married because I married somebody else. This is very convenient and it does fix everything. It means that we don't have to feel bad about the fact that he's been making eyes at Barbara Stanwyck this entire time, which is very typical for that period of film. There is so many films do that.
I will say, Dennis Morgan is one of those, he didn't act for very long. He stopped making movies, I think, in like 56. And then I think he just transitioned to television. He did a lot of romantic leading men parts for a while. He did a lot of musicals with Jack Carson, Doris Day, and then he did a couple westerns. He's always been a performer that people knew he should be in movies, but they didn't really know what to do with him in them. He's definitely the pleasant boy toy of this movie, and that's really all he is. Very cute. I don't despise him on a level with like Wesley Howard. If anybody's listening,
I'm gonna have to fight with you.
If you go back and listen to my Gone with the Wind episode, it was essentially me and my friend Terrence razzing on Ashley Wilt.
Well, I mean, Ashley is a terrible character, and Leslie Howard hated that part anyways. So that's
true. That's true.
I will give you that. But I love Leslie Howard.
See, and the thing is I have not seen the Leslie Howard movie that I liked him in. Maybe I'm watching the wrong thing.
Got to see some of his pre-code stuff, the Animal Kingdom. That's great.
Dennis Morgan, I can't say that I've seen anything. I like the movies, but I can never say that I like him in them. Mm-hmm. You brought up the character actors, specifically S.C. Sakal and Una O'Connor, who play Felix and Nora. S.C. Sakal is so fun in this movie. He's the one male ally that has Elizabeth's best interests at heart. He's given her cooking advice so that she can sell herself as this grand cook, and in turn she gave him a restaurant. He stops the wedding at numerous times throughout because he knows that she's not in love with John. He's the one who knows her best. And there's a great moment where he's asked, because everybody assumes he's her uncle, the judge asks him to give the bride away, and he says, I give no one away. There's a double meaning in that. The concept of he won't give her away in matrimony, and he also won't let people know that it's a lie. I love his little back and forth with Una O'Connor, specifically from like a cultural standpoint, the whole Irish stew versus goulash thing, that they're essentially the same. It's just one has paprika in it.
I loved that.
I thought it would have been really easy for them to hook up by the end of this movie, but they don't, which I really appreciated.
That actually would have been really cute. I mean, I like both of them just as character actors. They're wonderful. They're always so good in just about anything that they do. They elevate a film. So the film would be lesser without them. I love him. I mean, he's one of my favorite sort of secondary parts in Casablanca. The goulash, Irish stew, the playing back and forth of the very broad ethnic stereotypes that are nonetheless given greater depth by the actors that are playing them, and so begin to move outside of, they're not just these caricatures, they're actually these full people. Like you say, he's her uncle slash father figure who is doing his best to help her do what she wants to do as best he can. And that does include like being like, no, I'm not going to say it's okay for you to marry Sloane because you don't love Sloane and because Sloane is a jackass and I don't like him. I'm going to try to help you to get together with this attractive young soldier that you obviously want to be with. There's so much fun. There's so much fun to watch.
they give a good foil to how high concept the plot is. I want to touch really briefly on third act, because I feel the third act with the barn dance and the jail, I think it gets a little lost. Maybe because it reminds me of Remember the Night, which has that whole, we have to celebrate Christmas with a dance in the country.
I'm going to just fall back on this whole idea of the screwball comedy. A lot of the screwball comedies from the 30s and into the 40s did this, where you've got this great setup, and you have all of these like complications that are getting going, and then the third act in some way just makes everything that much more extreme. So, you know, you've got all of the nostalgia that is being set up with going to Christmas in Connecticut and this beautiful Connecticut farm and all of that. And then we're going to double down where everybody's doing country dances and everybody can dance perfectly. We're going to go on a sleigh ride through the snow and the babies are going to get kidnapped, but not really kidnapped. There are police officers everywhere. There are press people. It's just that extremity that maybe you kind of have to have in order to get all of those resolutions going. But at the same time, at least in the way that it plays today, it feels somewhat false. It does feel like there's now we have to bring in the final character to fix everything.
You bring up a good point that these movies start out so grand, and it's jokes upon jokes and setting up this Jenga tower, that I do feel a lot of these movies end up exhausting themselves by a certain point and just kind of running out of steam. It's not detrimental to the plot because cast is still so good, but you are feeling like, okay, maybe we should end this now. And the movie does not overstay its welcome. I do want to bring up some favorite moments before we close things out. I love the scenes with the babies. I do not like babies personally, but I really like them in this movie because, A, I am a fan of watching a single woman, maybe because I myself am a single woman, just be completely adrift with how to handle life. Barbara Stanwyck gets a baby because John has thought of everything. So he's gotten one of the local women who works at the munitions factory, who they have to go to work. The mothers have very weird ethnic accents, and so makes you wonder, why are all these white American people not working? She brings the one baby. She tells Jones that the baby's name is Robert, but you find out that the baby is a girl. So that's really funny. But then it culminates with that baby can't come back because the mother doesn't have to work. So another mother brings her baby, who is a boy. And because Felix doesn't want Elizabeth to get married, he says the baby swallows his watch. Yardley freaks out and he says, this baby looks different.
Yes.
It's a boy. It's blonde. And it talks. And Barbara Stanwyck just culminates with the line, well, now's not the time to take inventory. That scene never fails to make me laugh, just because it's... Yeah. And really, no one else ever questions it again.
When you mentioned that, I was just like, the part where Sydney Greenstreet is just like, wait a minute, that's a different baby. And I love the fact they just like pass by it. It's just like, yeah, we substituted out one baby for another, but we're going to pretend that it is exactly the same baby, even though they look completely different and are in fact different genders.
And Greenstreet's the only one who keeps bringing it up. When the baby gets kidnapped, he says, it's a boy. No, it's a girl. It's blonde hair. No, it has teeth or it doesn't. She's kept it isolated from all the other figures very deliberately. Mm-hmm. So no more than one person at a time really notices it. And then we gotta talk about the pancakes, because the whole movie, everybody's waiting for Barbara Stanwyck to get found out. Once she does get found out, it's not like this end of the world moment. She gets to flip the flapjacks. That works out okay for her. Sydney Greenstreet gets really upset that he thinks that he's hired this wanton woman who has a bastard child and she's not married, but things settle out really easy for her. And I think that starts with the pancakes.
I like the whole thing about Felix trying to teach her how to flip flapjacks. And I honestly do not know anybody that has ever been able to flip pancakes like that. Like,
unless it's in a movie, I've never seen anybody in the flesh
do. Yeah, exactly. Like, they do it all the time in like these 1940s films. Can you actually do that? I don't know if you can actually do that. And I like the exchanging of the babies. I really like the ending. At about the point where she has come back from jail and everybody is like going crazy and Greenstreet is calling her names and she's just like, yeah, baby's missing. It's not my baby. His mom probably took him. Like, she's just totally chill. She just thinks that she's reached a point where it's just so funny to her that she just doesn't care that much anymore. And she does get a chance to tell all of the men to go to hell, which I quite enjoy.
This is a Christmas movie that I think definitely deserves a bit more credit than it gets. I recommend this personally as a Christmas watch. It's very fun. Barbara Stanwyck has never looked better. I mean, I love some of her androgynous clothing choices. She embraces the collared shirts and the black. It's a lot of fun. Dennis Morgan does nothing for me, but the rest of it is good enough. Lauren, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I know a lot of people that only know Barbara Stanwyck from her film noir work. You gotta see her do comedy, because she really is good.
She has done so many great comedies and so many good romantic dramas. There's more than just noir. Then you get into the 50s, Stanwyck. I'm sorry, the hair choice in the 50s for her was not the best. Maybe we'll do a 50s Stanwyck film at some point in the future. Talk about that. Listeners, let me know your thoughts on Christmas in Connecticut, or you can talk about how I don't know what I'm talking about with Dennis Morgan and that he's really awesome. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and I can read them on the next episode. Once again, I would like to thank Lauren Humphreys-Brooks for joining me today. Lauren, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
They can find me on Twitter at LHBusiness, and I also have a WordPress site, suddenlyashotrangout.com.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. As always, you can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out with a rating or review. As always, you can contact me directly with questions or suggestions at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. Or if you want to send your suggestions or comments via Twitter, you can do that at ticklish_biz. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. You might want to check out Patreon, because that will be the only place that you can listen to my exclusive interview with Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story director, Alexandra Dean. So if you are interested in hearing that, head over to patreon.com to learn more. That's patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, because why not have Christmas extend beyond Christmas, I'm going to be including a special additional Christmas episode where guest Todd Liebenau and I talk about the 1947 Cary Grant feature, The Bishop's Wife. And if you want to hear our thoughts about its sequel, the 1996 film, The Preacher's Wife, you can listen to that in the coming days over at Walt Sent Me. So be sure to look out for that. And because it's the Christmas season, I would like to wish everybody a very happy holidays, Merry Christmas, whatever you choose to celebrate or not. Have a great and safe holiday, and we will see you after Christmas. So, till next time.